The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Diane Edelman for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from the Reader's Digest. First of four articles, Sisterhood to Last a Lifetime. These college pals teach a master class in how to maintain a friendship for 50-plus years, by Keelan Zoon and Maya Valentine. They got ready for parties and shared countless laughs as freshmen in the dormitories of the University of Maryland at College Park. They bonded over being black women at a university where, in 1971, only 4% of the student body was black. Friends dubbed the tight-knit group of women Sugar Hill, and the name stuck. It was unique for that many African-American females to be in one place, says Elizabeth Golston, an early member. During that time, you needed that kind of camaraderie and cohesiveness. On December 14, 1973, the women, most of them college seniors, gathered to celebrate a birthday and an early graduation. But that wasn't the end of the friend group. By the evening's end, they decided they should meet again the following December. And the next one. And the next one. For the past 50 years, the women have met at least once a year for dinners, sleepovers, and vacations. The 16 women of Sugar Hill Sisterhood, as they now call themselves, have leaned on one another through decades of milestones, weddings and graduations, baby showers and funerals. There's no challenge too big for the sisterhood, says Everine Johnson Turner. I could call in the troops in a minute. While many people have friendships that span decades, the women of Sugar Hill are something of a case study in what it takes to maintain them. Although the bond among them was forged during college, they've worked hard to stay connected and nurture their relationships. A group chat helps them stay in touch daily, as do phone calls, video chats, and remote group activities like a 90-day fitness challenge. They are committed to their annual reunions and have maintained unwavering support for one another. People are in awe that all these women, in all these years, we haven't had a fight, we haven't had a breakup or anything like that. We respect each other's individuality, says Jonetta Hill. The Sugar Hill Sisterhood has toured the world together, with trips to Jamaica, Spain, Italy, the Bahamas, Mexico, the United Arab Emirates, Brazil, Argentina, and Portugal, among many other places. And the women say that whatever is going on in their lives, they can look forward to spending time together every December. Last year, the group celebrated the 50th anniversary of their first December reunion with a trip to Granada. These trips are meaningful because for a lot of years, that was the only vacation I had, says Cassandra Stewart. We have the best time ever, and it really sets the tone for my year. When I'm with them, it's going to be nothing but good times. To make sure the trips and reunions keep happening, a designated trip coordinator is appointed each year. The coordinator will send a notice in mid-March or early April about the destination of the trip, along with an estimate of the total cost, says Joyce Wynn Dawkins. And it's an unspoken agreement to not say anything discouraging about the choice of location, says Linda Evans Cheek. If you want to go somewhere when it's your turn, we'll go there. The daily group chat messages include prayers, inspirational quotes, and life updates, Dawkins says. Time and friends are two things that become more valuable the older you get, reads one message. When it's someone's birthday, the group chat is filled with gifts, emojis, and well wishes. If the women ever need to have a deeper conversation, they will jump on a video call, as they did on Fridays during the height of COVID-19. And if someone in the group mentions she isn't feeling well, she knows she will hear from the others. Helen Jackson James recently experienced a throbbing headache and mentioned it to Sugar Hill's sister, Quintess Elizabeth Davis. Almost immediately, James started receiving concerned texts and calls from other women in the group. They were on top of me, asking, "Did you go to the doctor? Did you go to the emergency room?" says James. "They help me maintain my health and positive mind. We give each other strength, and when there's something challenging for us, we try to lift that person up." In the late 1970s, Dawkins' boyfriend died in a car accident. She had moved back to Baltimore, Maryland, and was mourning the loss when one of the Sugar Hill sisters, Sheila Perkins Hawks, persuaded Dawkins to come back to D.C. and live in an apartment with her. They stayed roommates for the next few years. "She nurtured my soul," Dawkins says. "That's all I can say. She let me cry when I wanted to cry." Stewart befriended most of the women through Dawkins, a high school friend. The sisterhood was there for Stewart at her lowest moment nearly 40 years ago when she was without permanent employment for 2 years. The sisterhood sent cards, covered her dinners, and even helped pay for her to attend the reunion trip that year. "That meant the absolute world to me," Stewart says. "I don't remember ever being that low in my life. It was just how they kept me encouraged. It just made me feel good about myself at a time when I didn't have that at all. I don't have biological sisters. I have all brothers, but I don't think I could have picked a better group of sisters." The group continues to debate the origins of its name. Several of the women believe it was started by male friends on campus. Sugar was a term of endearment toward the women, while Hill referred to the fact that they lived on the top floor of their residence hall. "It was all girls, and we were supposed to be all sweet sisters," says Angie Page. "Sugar is sweet, and we were young ladies up there." Group members say their name has become part of their identity, and now extends to family members. Husbands are referred to as sugar daddies, Johnson Turner says. Children are sugar babies, and grandchildren are sweet tarts. "Everything we call our families has to do with sugar," says Johnson Turner. The friends support one another's children and grandchildren, and the children of the sisterhood also spend time together. "It's a great feeling, knowing that we've passed the Sugar Hill legacy to our offspring, and they are passing it down to their offspring," Dawkins says. And before Dawkins got married in 1985, Cheek's husband explained to her fiancé that his commitment would extend beyond Dawkins. "Just make sure you want to do this," Dawkins recalls him saying. "You're marrying her, but you're marrying 15 other sisters as well." He was laughing, Dawkins says, but he was right. That was Sisterhood to Last a Lifetime by Kellen Soon and Maya Valentine. Our second article, The Bike Vigilantes. Your bicycle just got stolen. These volunteers will get it back. By John Clark. Mike Pavlik sees a lot while recovering stolen bikes around Minneapolis. Once, pretending to be a potential buyer, he dressed up in khakis and a sport coat and met a seller. Pavlik took note of the bike's make, model, and markings, confirming it was the one he was hunting. He asked to take it for a test ride. The seller wanted some collateral. "Do I look like the kind of guy that steals bikes, dude?" Pavlik recalls asking the man. Then he just pedaled off. An hour later, the seller texted him, "I guess you're not coming back?" Pavlik is part of an unusual army, amateur sleuths who find stolen bikes and return them to their owners. As bike theft becomes more profitable, grassroots efforts to thwart thieves are springing up nationwide. Part wannabe detective, part vigilantes, the volunteers say recovering bikes can be strangely fun and addictive. Pavlik, who is 51, works part-time at Trader Joe's when he's not gumshoeing for Twin Cities Stolen Bikes, which has a Facebook page with 11,000 members. The volunteer group reunites owners with their wheels, often by tracking stolen bikes for sale on Facebook Marketplace, OfferUp, Craigslist, or eBay, and then confronting alleged thieves. Pavlik likes helping victims almost as much as punishing thieves. "I like the ability to make someone happy who was victimized," he says. "I also like screwing someone over who isn't expecting it and deserves it." Similar efforts exist in Portland, Oregon, San Francisco, and Burlington, Vermont. In New Orleans, Stolen Bikes NOLA, N-O-L-A, has nearly 6,000 Facebook followers and an online success gallery. For Clark Thompson, a Stolen Bikes NOLA spokesman, a highlight is recovering someone's $50 Walmart bike. "It's how they get to work, and lack of transportation leads to losing a job," he says. So helping those folks where it really matters. Bike theft is big business, particularly with the arrival of costlier e-bikes. Close to 2 million bikes are stolen each year in North America, costing cyclists nearly $1 billion, compared with $500 million 10 years ago, according to bike registry Project 529. "It's been bananas lately," says Brian Hance, who helps run Bike Index, where cyclists can register their bikes online for free and report them stolen. More than 16,000 stolen bikes were reported last year, versus 11,000 in 2019. Hance says the thefts aren't high priority for police, creating space for volunteers. Police say they take bike theft seriously, though manpower to tackle it is a challenge. Unfortunately, in big cities and small towns across the country, we're facing staff retention issues, says Bill Johnson, executive director of National Association of Police Organizations. So it tends to get pushed to the back of the line. Hance at Bike Index is 48 and an avid cyclist who works in cybersecurity in Portland, Oregon. He says he got into this calling because far too many bikes went missing, and because he realized it's fun. "Finding these bad guys is like shooting fish in a barrel," he says. "I hate thieves." One recent morning, Hance was on the phone advising a victim how to go about meeting a seller and potential thief to recover his bike. "Meet at a bank and let security know what's about to go down, just to be safe," Hance told the man. "It usually goes okay," Hance says, "but not always. That's the stuff we're scared about." In this case, it went well. Jason Olson, a Vancouver architect Hance was helping, was trying to meet a seller who had his bike. Olson had identified the bike in an ad. After getting the runaround from the seller on when he would arrive, Olson called the police and had them retrieve the bike. The seller concocted a crazy story, just plausible enough not to get arrested, Olson says. Brent McNamara, a sales director who lives outside of San Francisco, had his bike stolen from his garage last year. He located it on Facebook Marketplace and contacted the police. But he says, since he did not record or register the serial number, there was nothing he could do to get it back. "It was brutal," he says. He bought a new bike and installed security cameras, a deadbolt on the garage door, and a system that locks the bike to the wall. In Minnesota, Twin Cities Stolen Bikes requires victims to file a police report before they start searching. They also want the bike registration, so the sleuths know they have the right bike and aren't stealing one themselves. "There's just a small, hardcore group of us," says Pavlik, who received an award from the Minneapolis Police Department in 2021 after setting up a seller who turned out to be a wanted felon. Pavlik has a certain skill set from working as a bartender and a National Guard police officer. "I can read people and talk to them really well," he says. "I'm also not afraid to get in someone's face. Most of these guys are cowards." While recovering more than 200 bikes, he says he has only been hit by a thief once. "I got sucker punched," he says. "So I pepper sprayed him, and he turned around and ran. The man's shorts fell down, and he tripped to the ground, leaving his bare rear exposed. I just emptied the whole can on him. Said a Minneapolis police spokesman, "While we commend all residents who step up to improve their communities, safety and lawfulness are paramount. We do not endorse aggressive tactics that put anyone in harm's way." One guy who public says allegedly runs a bike theft ring also stands out. The first time he confronted the man with a bike's proof of ownership, the man pedaled off. Public gave chase on his bike and shot him with pepper spray until he crashed. "I got him," he says. "Then I just lifted the stolen bike on my shoulder and sped off. Another victory." That was The Bike Vigilantes by John Clark. Our third article, just a snore or something more. Sleep apnea is on the rise, and it can be dangerous. How to tell if you or your sleeping partner has it, by Beth Winehouse. Lots of people snore. In fact, almost half of all adults do. Most of the time, it's just an annoyance for the people who are trying to sleep next to them. But sometimes it's a sign of something more, a breathing disorder called sleep apnea. In the U.S., about 10% of the adult population, which is roughly 30 million people, have sleep apnea, says Atul Malhotra, M.D., a professor of medicine and a sleep medicine specialist at the University of California, San Diego. Worldwide, about 1 billion people have sleep apnea. The disorder is increasing in prevalence because of the obesity epidemic and the aging population. More awareness and better technology for diagnosing sleep apnea also contribute to the rise in cases, says Dr. Malhotra. The problem isn't the snoring, but the reason behind it. The most common type of sleep apnea, called obstructive sleep apnea, OSA, is caused by weakened throat muscles relaxing too much during sleep, causing the airway to narrow or close. That leads to snoring, plus shallow breathing and long pauses between breaths, followed by gasping for air. And when breathing is affected this way at night, the brain isn't getting the oxygen it needs, and the body isn't getting the sleep it needs either. Snoring is the most obvious symptom, but people who sleep alone or with partners who are very sound sleepers may not even know that they snore, pause their breathing, or gasp. People who wear recent versions of the Apple Watch can turn on sleep apnea notifications. Because OSA prevents a good night's sleep, people may feel tired and irritable during the day, suffer from headaches, and even develop depression. In fact, it's often daytime symptoms that bring people to the doctor for diagnosis and treatment. Age and weight are considered the biggest risk factors for sleep apnea, but anyone of any age, including children, and any body size can develop it. Other risk factors include smoking, having a thick neck or narrow throat, family history, use of alcohol or sedatives, and certain medical conditions, including heart or kidney failure and some endocrine disorders. Treating sleep apnea is far more important than just stopping the snoring. The body relies on good sleep for general health, and without it, you might experience mood changes, forgetfulness and fuzzy thinking, neurological problems, a weakened immune system, and an increased risk of many physical ailments. Sleep apnea has even been linked to an increased risk of heart attack and stroke, though the data on this point is a little less clear, says Dr. Malhotra. The diagnosis requires several steps. Besides a medical history and a physical exam, doctors may try to rule out other conditions, such as asthma or thyroid disorders, that cause similar symptoms. And they may recommend a sleep study, which usually involves a monitor that patients can use at home to check on breathing, heart rate, and other functions during sleep. Once the condition has been diagnosed, there are many options for treatment. For mild cases and people who are overweight, lifestyle changes like improving diet and exercise habits and losing excess pounds can sometimes be enough to reverse sleep apnea. Stopping smoking and drinking may help. Even switching from sleeping on your back to sleeping on your side may offer relief. When treatment is required, the most common is a machine called a CPAP, which stands for Continuous Positive Airway Pressure. CPAP is a mask that prevents collapse in the back of the throat, explains Dr. Malhotra. It has an unnecessarily bad reputation, since it's well tolerated by most patients, but you need to find the right mask and the right pressure settings. Some patients, though, can't adjust to sleeping well with the mask on. For those people, there are other types of PAP machines, and there are oral appliances that a certified dentist can make that prevent collapse in the back of the throat, says Dr. Malhotra, referring to custom devices that cover the teeth and have a hinge that sets the bottom jaw forward a little when you sleep, which keeps the airway open. There are also certain surgeries that can be done to keep the airways open, he says. These include implanting a hypoglossal nerve stimulation device. Inspire is the only FDA-approved one so far. Other options are surgeries to remove tonsils or excess tissue, for example. But these are a last-line treatment after less invasive methods have failed. Researchers are studying new options. Dr. Malhotra recently led research that found the diabetes and weight loss drug tirzepatide, Mounjaro Zepbound, is also an effective treatment for sleep apnea. It's currently under consideration by the FDA for this use, and if approved, would be the first medication treatment for sleep apnea. There are many other trials underway to evaluate new drug treatments. Dr. Malhotra says that researchers are also trying to develop new devices that will stimulate the tongue muscles during the daytime so they work better at night. With so many options, no one should have to miss a good night's sleep because of sleep apnea. As author, digital pioneer, and passionate sleep advocate Arianna Huffington has said, the way to a more productive, more inspired, more joyful life is getting enough sleep. That was Just a Snore or Something More by Beth Winehouse. Our fourth and last article, A New Way to Monitor Blood Sugar. Who can benefit from this wearable technology? By Beth Winehouse. You may have noticed them last summer when the weather got warm enough for t-shirts. Those square or round, somewhat three-dimensional patches on people's upper arms, though they can be worn elsewhere too. They're too raised to be estrogen or nicotine patches. So what are they? They're continuous glucose monitors, CGMs, prescribed by physicians for people with diabetes to help them keep track of and control their blood sugar levels. As of the end of the summer, one of these monitors, the Stilo biosensor from Dexcom, became available without a prescription, giving a new group of Americans the chance to improve their health by wearing one. CGMs measure blood sugar, but they don't actually require blood to do it. The patches cover tiny sensor wires that are inserted, painlessly, just under the skin to check glucose levels in interstitial fluid, the liquid that contains glucose and other substances leaked from blood capillaries. The CGM constantly monitors glucose levels and sends reports to a user's smartphone or other device. These monitors have traditionally been prescribed to people with either type 1 or type 2 diabetes who are insulin dependent. The monitor helps people adjust their insulin doses to keep their blood sugar close to normal range. Some of the monitors are even connected to insulin pumps that do the work automatically. But doctors have long felt that people with type 2 diabetes who are not insulin dependent could also benefit from the information these monitors provide. Some doctors have been prescribing them for that use, even though most health insurance policies will cover the cost only for people who use insulin. The first over-the-counter CGM, Stilo Biosensor, is specifically recommended for adults 18 and older with type 2 diabetes or prediabetes, when blood sugar is higher than normal, but not yet high enough to be diagnosed as diabetes, who do not use insulin. There are 25 million people with type 2 diabetes who are not on insulin, and an additional 100 million people with pre-diabetes, says Thomas Grace, MD, Dexcom's head of clinical advocacy and outcomes, who calls himself the retired finger poker. The monitor can give these people new insights into what they're eating. They'll see how activity benefits their glucose levels. Their hemoglobin A1C will come down. They'll become more confident, and their quality of life will improve. Because making CGMs available over the counter is so new, there's little data yet to confirm the benefits for other groups of people. But there's hope that the monitors will be beneficial for non-diabetics as well, including people taking medications that can raise blood sugar, people who have a strong family history of diabetes and are worried about developing it themselves, and people with obesity who are at high risk of developing diabetes. While the Stilo is the first monitor to be available over the counter, inevitably others will follow. And companies that make these monitors obviously have incentive to promote their use to other groups, such as healthy people without diabetes, who want to check their blood sugar the way they might check their blood pressure, weigh themselves, or track their heart rate, calories, or steps. Right now, though, there's no evidence that you can optimize your blood sugar for peak health or physical performance. And since normal blood sugar fluctuates during the day, someone could misread a temporarily low or high reading as dangerous. We don't want people to misinterpret what really is normal and medicalize normal blood sugar fluctuations, says Kevin Peterson, MD, Vice President for Primary Care at the American Diabetes Association, who cautions that interpreting the monitor's information should be done in conjunction with a medical professional. One more thing to know is that because the monitor is being sold over the counter, people will most likely have to pay for it out of pocket rather than it being covered by insurance. Check with your carrier. The Dexcom Stilo's price is $99 a month or $89 with a subscription plan. Sensors are designed to last up to 15 days before they need replacing. That was A New Way to Monitor Blood Sugar by Beth Winehouse. We've run out of time for today's episode. I'm Diane Edelman, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Reader's Digest is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any questions or comments, please call area code 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service. Thank you.